Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Today on the Midday News Wrap, we'll begin with some items from Washington. Months ago, the special counsel Jack Smith asked the Supreme Court to review the immunity case put forth by lawyers for Donald Trump, skipping the process of letting the case go through the lower courts. The Supreme Court refused that request. This week, the High Court agreed to review the case, which was decided by an appeals court which found that Mr. Trump or any president is not immune from prosecution. Arguments are scheduled for the week of April 22nd. SCOTUS blog reports, in a one-page unsigned order, the justices ordered a federal appeals court to continue to keep a hold on its ruling, rejecting Trump's claims of immunity from prosecution, and they fast-tracked the case for oral arguments in April. So April 22nd, that week, is the Supreme Court's version of fast-tracking. The decision by the court will delay three of the four cases in which Mr. Trump has been indicted, including the Georgia election interference case, the classified documents case, and the January 6, 2021 insurrection case. New York DA Alvin Bragg's case about paying Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal to stay quiet during the 2016 election apparently will go forward later this month. On Capitol Hill, for the fourth time since last September, House Republicans passed a stopgap bill that avoids a partial government shutdown, which could have happened tomorrow. The Senate followed suit late last night. A shutdown may still happen next week or by the end of the month. Bills to provide aid for Ukraine and Israel have not moved forward. Today on the News Wrap, we'll take a look at what the Maryland General Assembly has been up to as we approach the halfway mark in the 2024 session. Pamela Wood covers the State House for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, and she joins us on our digital line. Pam, how you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm doing better than yesterday.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in just a second. And Matt Bush is WYPR's news director. He's hanging with me here in Studio A. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you, Tom.
And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on what's going on in Annapolis at the General Assembly, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Pamela Wood, you were in the State House last night when a lockdown was ordered for a couple of hours. Tell us what happened and where you were, and my gosh, that must have been scary.
It was scary for several minutes there. I was, along with several other reporters from the Banner and other outlets, on the ground floor of the State House. There's a series of offices down there for the press, and the chief of staff to the House Speaker, Jeremy Baker, just suddenly around 5 o'clock came down the hallway and urgently told us to close and lock the doors. And we didn't know what was going on, so we locked up, we turned off the lights, we kind of hid and crouched in there, all of us, unsure really what was happening at all. And we were there for about half an hour before we were escorted out. And later we learned there was a threat phoned into the Annapolis Police Department, someone claiming that they had a gun and they were headed to the State House. And the whole thing, actually, the buildings were locked down for about 2 hours last night in total. And for about 30 minutes, a lot of us had to shelter in place before police escorted us to another area.
And how did that happen? How did the police contact you or come to you and assure you that they were, in fact, the police and it was safe to answer the knock on the door?
Yeah, absolutely. We could actually see through a little. There's one of the doors we have has a little mail slot in it, and we could see through there that there were police, you know, with big guns in the hallway. And, you know, they came down room by room down our hallway and banged on the doors, said they were police, asked who was in there, and they hustled us right out of there. The hallway of the State House lined with police officers with long guns, and they urgently told us to move and get out of there, and got us out of the building, and then ultimately took us down the street and held us in another building for a while.
In another building, because I know the State Circle, the road that surrounds the steakhouse, the State House was closed. I mean, but they wanted you inside another building. They didn't want you hanging around outside.
That's right. They had us outside on Lawyers Mall. That's the plaza next to the State House for a little bit. And then they decided it was safer to move us down to the House of Delegates office building. And, you know, meanwhile, the House of Delegates office building, the Senate office building were full of people. There were committee hearings, voting sessions happening, people giving testimony. And some of that business continued, but they also were kept, everybody was kept inside those buildings. They didn't want us, you know, out on the streets. And until about 7 o'clock, we got the all clear.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it all started at about 5.
Yeah. Wow. So that's, you know, a couple hours to be sure. So Matt Bush, you got down there around 7:30 or so and talked to Carter Elliott, who is a press spokesperson for Governor Wes Moore. What did they have to say?
And all the reporters there, Pam was there as well. And Carter was just saying what they were up on the second floor where the governor's office is, and that the governor was in there. The lieutenant governor was in the building. The Senate president was in the building. Just how they sort of passed the time waiting for it to happen. The governor had a reception that was previously scheduled across the street at the governor's mansion with mayors from around the state. He was delayed in getting to that. He eventually did get to it for a little bit, but that's pretty much what it was. And it sounded like an exceptionally harrowing incident for everybody who was there.
Yeah, sure. And of course, many of those mayors did get inside the governor's mansion. And as I understand it from some reporting from WBAL's Dave Collins, other mayors who arrived a little later weren't even let into the governor's mansion. They were told to go someplace else and clear the area. Well, Pamela Wood, we're very glad that you're okay and that all of your colleagues are too. But of course, in this day and age, where mass shootings are more than frequent, it's you know, a very scary thing to think that somebody could you know, make a threat like that. And of course, it had to be taken very seriously. Let's talk about some of the bills that are going through the legislative process in the General Assembly. The Juvenile Justice Bill, Pam. This has gained a lot of steam over the last couple of weeks. As I understand it, they're talking about it as we speak. What's your take on the status of that? First of all, what do these bills aspire to do? This is in some way a reaction to bills that the legislature passed last year or the year before.
Yeah, that's right. I actually just left the House of Delegates chamber, where it is on the agenda for a final vote today, a third reader vote, it's called. Legislation is moving forward both in the House and the Senate. It makes some tweaks to juvenile justice law. One example is extending the amount of time that a kid can be on probation. The idea is keep them on probation longer. It gives them more time to get sort of the oversight and the services that come with that, rather than sort of, you know, quickly in 6 months sending them out. That's, you know, controversial. There is addressing the issue.
Oh, and we've lost the connection with Pam Wood. Matt Bush is here with me in Studio A, and our connection's still okay as
yes.
far as I know. So
I can
see we are working on getting Pamela Wood back with us. But this is a reaction to a bill that, you know, a couple of bills, a package of reform bills
right.
that were passed recently.
Yeah, and I think it's also a reaction to a lot of the coverage that has come out, particularly in Baltimore, of crime. Always worth noting as we discuss this, that crime is falling statewide and the juvenile crime rate is falling too, but there's some specific instances they want to address. And Pam was getting into that, saying the one with lengthening probation, but also allowing the Department of Juvenile Services to basically take in 10 to 12 year olds who would be charged with certain crimes, certain violent crimes. This includes carjacking and assault. Instead of just getting services, they now go into the Department of Juvenile Services, which is kind of the beginning of the criminal justice system at that area or at that age, instead of just allowing them to be, you know, to get services for these crimes. So I think that's one of the bigger, you know, changes that really comes out of this. And it's the one that's gotten the most criticism from a lot of, you know, Democratic leaning groups. This is going to pass, but that's where a lot of the criticism has really come from, is over that, saying it's going to put a lot more kids into the criminal justice system, and in particular black and brown kids, by having kids at that age be now subject to DJS intervention.
Yeah, and so Pamela Wood, it's an interesting coalition of people who are behind these reform packages, so-called juvenile justice reform packages, because it's a lot of law enforcement people, including some Democrats like Ivan Bates, the state's attorney here in Baltimore, and proponents of the bill. I guess it's Will Smith, who's a senator, and Luke Clippinger in the House, are hearing from people both on the left and the right. It's an interesting political place that they're in. with this particular package of legislation, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. There is honestly frustration with this bill from all sides, from the left, from the right. There have been amendments proposed and rejected by from Republicans and from, liberal Democrats as well. And Delegate Sandy Bartlett, one of the folks who's worked on this, said, I don't think everybody's certainly not happy here. Definitely a recognition of how challenging this is.
Yeah, I think Senator Smith was quoted in Maryland Matters today saying, everybody's mad about it. That must mean we're doing something right, is the way the political process works. But Matt Bush, it does look like this will pass the House and pass the Senate. So you think that these reforms will, in fact, be implemented.
Right. And some of the reporting from the Banner has said the reason this is going through a little earlier than it maybe would large headlining legislation is once it goes through the House and they're debating it right now, the final vote, and then the Senate, it's on second reader, so they have to vote on it one more time. They'll do that early next week. That gives then the sides more time to work on this particular bill. They've heard from their colleagues now the things they like and mostly dislike about it. So going forward, we'll see what they come up with. What's interesting I found in some of the certainly going in with the coverage or what the questions were about this bill going into the year when it was introduced was would it take away something that was passed 2 years ago, one thing in particular, the Child Interrogation Act, which basically allows or ensures that juveniles have access to an attorney before they are questioned by police. And a lot of prosecutors, Democrats and Republicans, have criticized the saying as has hampered police investigations. That is not, they're not making any changes to that. That was one of the amendments that Pamela was referring to that was brought up this week, was putting, basically negating that bill in some way, and that amendment was defeated. So that's still part, that is the law. That won't be changed, at least by what's going through right now. But we still have another month or so to go.
Matt Bush is WIPR's news director. Pamela Wood covers the State House and politics and government for the Baltimore Banner, our news partner. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And Pam Wood, Senator Carter, whom Matt just referred to, was a big proponent of the Child Interrogation Protection Act, and she was able to see that no changes were made to that particular law. I had her on Midday here a couple months ago talking about that. She was also behind a bill called the Nikayla Strotter Bill. That was against, I guess, part of the juvenile justice reform package, and then it became separated from it. What can you tell us about that bill that Senator Carter has sponsored?
Yeah, sorry, I lost you for a moment there. We're talking about the Nikayla Strotter Act?
Yes, yes.
Is that right? Yes. So that bill is named for a Baltimore girl who was shot and killed, unfortunately, by another child. And her family has been on a mission. What they want to see is that when kids take an action that takes a life, that they automatically get put into some services, some counseling, some supports for them and their family. It got rolled into the larger bill, and Nikayla's family doesn't like all the aspects of the larger bill. So they raise that concern. It's since being separated out, and it is moving forward. And, their goal is really to help kids who are in trouble.
So this would dictate that this is two kids playing with a gun, or a young child playing with a gun who ended up, discharging the weapon, and Nikayla Strotter very tragically was killed. But this would mandate that juvenile supervision, juvenile services would immediately become involved. Is that right? Is that what you just explaining?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And not to criminally charge a child. The child in this case was too young to be charged, not to lock them up and send them away, but to get them help, because something's, very much going wrong when that happens, when, children, have guns, when they hurt other people, they need help. And that was the goal of that legislation, to require that they, get put into the system to get help, but not for incarceration.
Pamela Wood covers state government and politics for the Baltimore Banner. Matt Bush is the news director here at WIPR. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap on the other side of a quick break. We'll talk about the budget. We'll talk about some education bills. We're talking about some other things that are happening in the General Assembly in Annapolis. They're about halfway done with the 2024 session. We are not by any means done. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WIPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen, a former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and a columnist for The Washington Post. The CDC has a new COVID vaccine recommendation for older adults. We'll talk about that. There's measles in Maryland. We'll talk about that and the best ways to protect ourselves from America's number one killer, that's heart disease. Dr. Nguyen explains the latest data and answers your questions on Midday Monday. And if you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. My guests are two experienced Annapolis watchers who are helping us keep up with the latest from the General Assembly. Pamela Wood is the politics and government reporter for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. She's in Annapolis joining us on our digital line. Matt Bush is the news director here at WIPR. He's with me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well if you have a question or comment for our two experienced Annapolis hands. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. So, Pamela Wood, there was a bill that has been proposed in the legislature more than once. It's referred to as Medical Aid in Dying. And Senate President Bill Ferguson had an announcement about that this morning at his press conference. Here's what he had to say.
Another important bill that I do want to address is the Medical Aid in Dying or Compassionate Choices. We are not going to be taking a vote on the bill this year. Does not appear that we have the votes to pass it in the Senate, and so we will not be moving forward on that issue, which I know will be disappointing for a number of folks, but if the votes aren't there, the votes aren't there, and so we will continue in the education process and take it up at a different time when we think that there's a better chance of its passage.
So, Pam, what do you think? What was the... dare I say it, death knell for this bill, concerning a very sensitive issue for patients, requesting aid at the last stage of their life.
Yeah, and what this bill would do is allow terminally ill patients to get a prescription for medication that they would have to take themselves to, initiate their death. And honestly, just the votes weren't there. Not enough people are comfortable with it. At the beginning of session, President Ferguson told me there was interest in bringing it up for vote this year. That was the plan. But as it got closer and became more real, not enough senators were ready to go forward with it. So it's not going to get a vote this year.
And Matt Bush, I guess the people had concerns about what this would mean for insurance policies.
All sorts of things with this. Yeah. I mean, this is going back a decade, I think, that this has been brought up in Maryland. And our reporter, Scott Massian, our health reporter, was doing some digging on this and was preparing a report on it. And it was interesting coming into the session was felt if Maryland approved it, it might be the tipping point state because only a handful of states allow this right now. But if Maryland had approved it, there may have been a lot of other states that then followed suit. So the fact that this is done for this year and isn't going to be passed is very interesting in a national scope as well, is how many more people are going to push this through. But there's lots of questions with it. Insurance probably being the biggest one that people just don't know what, and I think as you were pointing out too, the people have to take the prescriptions themselves. Terminally ill patients may not have the physical ability to do that. So there's a lot of questions that were coming with this that apparently just have not been answered enough at this point.
Yeah, but it looks like Senate President is optimistic he can, keep it in the fore of people's consciousness in future sessions. Speaking of health care, Pam Wood, the Access to Care Act would allow undocumented immigrants to go to the health exchange to buy insurance. I guess the bill has passed in the House. Where does that stand?
Yeah, actually, last night I was watching online the Senate Finance Committee voting session on this bill when the threat came through. So it is moving forward in the Senate as well. It's important to note this bill does not offer any financial assistance or subsidies. These folks who could use the exchange to pay their own way, to buy their own health insurance. And, you know, right now, undocumented immigrants aren't allowed to use the state health exchange. So this would open it up. It would take a couple of years for this to be implemented, should it go all the way through the General Assembly, which is looking likely.
And Matt Bush, I remember many years ago during the O'Malley administration, there was a big conversation about whether or not undocumented immigrants should get the in-state rate at colleges and universities,
Act, yeah.
The DREAM Act here in Maryland. You've been covering some of the other education stories. One of them has to do with legacy preference in admissions. This was the subject of a Supreme Court case last term.
Right. So interesting to always see how Maryland reacts, you know, the Maryland lawmakers, which are primarily Democratic, react to these rulings from the conservative U.S. Supreme Court. So this did pass with almost unanimously, 133-4. It bans legacy preference to be used in admissions. Now, from what the research on this does, a lot of the by any school should preface that. It's any school that takes state money in any form. So it isn't just state schools. There's a lot of private schools that take state funding in some form. So it would ban them from legacy preference, using legacy preference in determining admissions. It passed 133-4 in the House. So it's going now to the Senate to go through that. Most of the public schools do not do this in Maryland, according to the research. St. Mary's is the only one that does. And it, apparently it's not a very heavily used criteria in their admissions process. What was interesting, there was a separate bill about this, and there was a really volatile hearing about it that had something to do with this. It was a separate bill that looks like it's not going anywhere. But another bill that got passed this year is requiring all the state schools to do targeted outreach and recruitment efforts. And there seemed to be a lot of the anger that's really being directed right now at the University of Maryland College Park from a lot of lawmakers that aren't from Montgomery County or Prince George's County, that the University of Maryland College Park is not accepting enough students from other parts of the state. Something interesting to look forward to going forward, because there was a lot of discussion of it that got kind of heated for a, Senate committee hearing about this. And that has to do whether it's legacy admissions, whether they believe that people are prepared to go to that school. There's some displeasure in other parts of the state about whether enough kids from Maryland can get into the state school, the largest one in the state.
Yeah, interesting. Of course, the Supreme Court has ruled that race can no longer be used as a criteria.
And that's
for
where the legacy sort of comes in, that it benefits primarily white students. And again, there wasn't, at least according to the research, wasn't many schools in Maryland that receive state funds that are used to this. There's four private universities that apparently also that are taking state money that use legacy preference. But I mean, going through it 133-4, that's not a lot of, not a lot of controversy to ban this. We'll see if it gets through the Senate. But some of the other things that were very interesting about this particular issue don't seem to be going forward.
Pam Wood, let's talk about the budget. I get the same press releases from the Republican caucus that you do. You and Matt both get, we get one once a week or so that highlights what they call the Democrat tax hikes of the week proposals. So taxes are kind of at least in the periphery of people's conversations in Annapolis this session, but where do things stand with the budget? We heard from the governor months before the session started that the structural deficits of the state are going to be pretty substantial. Where do things stand at this point in the session?
That's right. The budget we expect to be moving forward next week. We're going to get some new estimates of how much money is coming in, and we're going to see how lawmakers are changing the governor's budget proposal, which, to be clear, does not have any across-the-board tax increases for anybody. The governor has said his bar is really high, maybe a discussion for the future, but not this year. What Republicans have been talking about in the last couple weeks is a variety of relatively minor fee increases that they're calling taxes. There are some fee increases for hunters who come in from out of state. There is a new program for paint recycling that would charge a small fee per can of paint to set up. Relatively small dollar items, but they're certainly making a big deal out of it.
I guess there is some proposal having to do with fees or taxes on the purchase of guns and ammunition. What can you tell us about that proposal?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So if you're buying a gun or bullets, you're paying the regular 6% sales tax already. There is a proposal to add an 11% tax, and that would be on the dealer, but let's be real, the dealers are going to pass that on to consumers. That 11% tax would help fund the trauma system. So shock trauma in Baltimore, the other trauma centers and transportation around the state, the trauma system has been in need of money and has been given extra money from the state. The idea here is to help make it more sustainable, and frankly, guns through, you know, intentional acts, you know, accidents send a lot of people to trauma centers for expensive care.
Yeah, it's you know, a thing that people are wrestling with around the country, you know, and Matt Bush, the active shooter drills are even a subject of concern for legislators here in Annapolis. And here's last night, you know, that could have very easily been an active shooter situation. It turns out, thank God, it wasn't. But the lawmakers are thinking about legislating how these drills are conducted.
Yeah, the House passed a bill that would essentially stop any active shooter drills or trainings in schools that would include specified activities that may be considered traumatic for students or personnel. Now, that would mean banning anything that included loud noises that imitate gunfire or explosions, and would stop anyone from role-playing as the victim or the shooter in these drills that have become commonplace in schools. And this is one thing they're looking at. I've read stories about how what some of these do, and they do sound, they can sound traumatic, but this is what's passed. It's passed the House. We'll see if it goes any further.
Yeah, it's interesting. How do you have an active shooter drill when you're preparing people for just a horrible situation that doesn't include some, you know, difficult, traumatic elements? I mean, it's a really difficult thing. That's one of those issues where it's difficult to legislate that sort of thing, I think. So we'll see. But, you know, as you mentioned, the House is for it. Pamela Wood, let's move to Governor Moore's proposal. He's very much behind something called the Enough Act. What does the Enough Act refer to?
Yeah, that's right. Governor Moore was making his pitch again this morning before Senate committee. Earlier, he was before the House of Delegates. The Enough Act would send $15 million a year in grants to targeted communities throughout the state. These are neighborhoods that have high levels of children who are in poverty, and the grants are meant for community supports, you know, job training, tutoring, you know, improving safety and opportunities in these neighborhoods. This is part of the governor's, as he says, an audacious goal to end child poverty in the state. But with the tight budget situation, he got a warning earlier from the House that, do we have the money to sustain this long-term $15 million a year before? And, you know, he's also getting questions that, is $15 million enough to move the needle and really make a difference? You know, once you take $15 million, you spread it around, you know, 10 or 20 different neighborhoods across the state, is that enough to make a difference? So he's getting a lot of support for it, but some questions in the details.
Yeah, he calls it the first in the nation state-level effort to end concentrated poverty. It is, in fact, an audacious goal. And it's interesting, Matt, Enough is not an acronym. Yeah, it's just it's what they've named this bill because he says, this is quoting the governor, we've had enough with poverty, enough with crime, and a system where generational challenges go addressed. So it's kind of, you know, we're fed up, we're not, you know, we're mad, we ain't going to take it anymore.
Absolutely. You get good branding on a bill when you come up with something like that. You get a branding's part of it sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pam Wood, the governor also is proposing some housing legislation that's part of his package of bills this year. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, he has a package of bills, and again, he was also testifying in the Senate this morning on them. One that's most interesting and is running into some concerns would incentivize more units of development in certain areas. These are developments near transit stations, developments on former state properties, developments that are mostly affordable housing. But this runs into local control. Local governments, it's very important for them to control where development happens, and specifically to make sure that schools aren't overcrowded, that development doesn't, you know, make the roadways worse, that it doesn't overburden the sewer system. It's called Adequate Public Facilities Ordinances, or APFO is what we're hearing a lot in Annapolis. Mm-hmm. But everybody recognizes there is a shortage of housing at all price points, and there's specifically a shortage of housing in our state at, you know, affordable working class, middle class price points. So there is a broad desire to get the housing supply up, but at the same time, keep enough controls so that it works in harmony with existing neighborhoods. So there's going to be a lot of conversations about that. I wouldn't be surprised if the governor's bill gets some adjustments from lawmakers moving forward.
Yeah, it's a state issue. Of course, it's very much a local issue. Affordable housing very much on the minds of Mayor Brandon Scott and Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. They've got a very expensive proposal out there. Johnny Olszewski Jr., the county executive in Baltimore County, who's now running for Congress, was sort of swatted back when he tried to introduce an ordinance that would have helped him build more affordable housing, which he needs to do because he's under a consent decree in the county to do that. So it's interesting that, you know, this is happening both at the micro local level as well as the more macro state level. Matt Bush, there's also on the education beat, again, a bill having to do with children who are taking classes about what they call family life and human sexuality in Maryland schools. Where does that stand?
So that's through the House, I believe. Actually, I should go click back on that. But yeah, I believe it's through the House. And yes, it's passed the House. The Senate has its own version of it. But this creates a public health curriculum that students at, you know, any grade level, they would have classes that deal with a variety of things. But right now, parents could opt their kids out under this bill only for family life and human sexuality classes. They cannot opt them out for gender identity, sexual orientation, or HIV prevention classes under this bill. This is, without having said that this is in response to Carroll County Public Schools, it's in response to Carroll County Public Schools, as they would be the only school system right now that would not that would be violating this particular policy, as they have done some things with banning LGBTQ plus books and symbols and all that kind of thing. So this is in response to that, without saying it's in response to it. So that one's going to be pretty volatile as it goes through. It was going through the House. There was a lot of pushback on this, but it is through the House and now goes to the Senate, their version of this. So as states all across the country are, you know, looking at banning books, don't say gay, those sorts of things, this is what Maryland's response is to it.
Matt Bush is the news director here at WIPR. Pamela Wood covers state government and politics for the Baltimore Banner. We're going to be talking for another few minutes about what's going on in the General Assembly. If you have a question or comment, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And Pam Wood, there was a weird thing. I mean, I'm defining it or describing it as weird because it seemed kind of strange to me that all of a sudden there was a program that had to do with pretrial treatment of people who are suspected and indicted in crimes, having to do with their ankle monitors. All of a sudden, the State Department said, well, we're out of money. We can't do this anymore. And the Judiciary Committee in the General Assembly has taken a look at this. What's going on with this business to refund this program? Oh, we've lost Pamela for a second. We'll try to get her back. Matt, is this something that you've followed at all?
I have not followed this one.
Okay, no, right. It has to do with financial assistance for pretrial ankle monitors. Mm-hmm. And they ran out of money, and the legislature, I know Bill Ferguson was very upset that all of a sudden, you know, unbeknownst to anybody, we stopped doing that because we ran out of money. So there are lawmakers working to fund it. We just have a few minutes left. So, Matt, I want to talk to you about renaming the snakehead fish. We got a question about this yesterday when I talked to the Maryland executive director of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. There's a bill called HB 19, and it regards the snakehead fish. What an appetizing name for so, a main meal.
We'll put it this way. Would you go to a restaurant and say, hey, I would like a snakehead? No. For a lot of people, it's no. So would you go to a restaurant instead when you see on the menu, I'll order a Chesapeake Chana? Well, they're banking on that more people will find that a more appetizing thing to purchase at a restaurant than a northern snakehead. The snakehead's an invasive fish, arrived in Maryland about 20 years ago or so. It's predatory, and it's basically one in the Maryland ecosystem. They can't get rid of it despite the efforts they've done. So now they're going to rename it in hopes that more people will eat it when they're out wherever, buy it, eat it, whatever, if it's called Chesapeake Jana instead of the northern snakehead. Right. That's pretty much it. It's an invasive fish. It's not native to this area. It's native to East Asia, but about 20 years ago, it showed up in a pond in Crofton. Then a couple years later, was in the Potomac River. Apparently, the waters here are very conducive to its development, and it's here to stay. So.
And there's way too many of these snakehead fish, Pam. So they're pushing it because I'm told by various legislators at various levels of government that the snakehead fish is actually really delicious. They say we should be ordering them up as frequently as possible. Have you ever had one, Pam? A Chesapeake Chana, perhaps I should say, rather than a snakehead fish?
I have actually. Before I was a politics reporter, I was an environment and Chesapeake Bay reporter. So I did have the opportunity to have snakehead fish, but gosh, that was 10 years ago. I don't really remember what it tasted like. I'm not a big fish eater, but yeah, they're hoping it's going to be more marketable with this new name. I'm not sure. I would order snakehead if I saw it on the menu.
Yeah. I mean, branding is everything, right?
Branding is everything. Yeah.
And so Pam, I want to talk about Speaker Jones. She has what she's referring to as her decency agenda. What's involved in that agenda?
Yeah, that's a series of bills, some sponsored by the speaker herself, some by other delegates that she is giving her blessing to. One of the main ones is the Freedom to Read Act, which attacks the issue of book banning that's been going on. We've seen it in Carroll County, now Howard County, parents trying to take books out of school libraries in particular, often with LGBTQ+ content. And this bill would set standards for all public libraries and school libraries about the goal of keeping a variety of books available for people and setting some standards and protecting librarians who follow those rules. So that has been heard in both chambers, and it is expected to go forward. There's also a bill clarifying an anti-discrimination law in unemployment, some bills aimed at combating misinformation and disinformation about the voting process. And she's put these all together under the umbrella of decency and trying to promote, dialogue and conversation in a respectful way in our society, which is, gosh, a really big problem that she's, doing what she can to try and address it.
Well, Pamela Wood, we appreciate your explaining what's happening down there on your beat in a very civil and respectful way and a very informative way. So I'm really grateful to you. Thank you so much, and stay safe down there.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Pamela Wood covers politics and government for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, and Matt Bush is the news director here at WIPR. Thank you, sir, for your fine reporting from the State House.
And thank you. We'll tell you the juvenile justice bill did pass the House a few minutes ago, 126-6.
All right, so that's a pretty overwhelming margin for the juvenile justice bill. Up next, our weekly theater review with J. Wynn Russick. We'll talk about the Oresteia at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.